Today is Tuesday, November 17th, 2020. This is part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Carl. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing well.
Good. Carl, may we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
You certainly do.
Thank you very much. You completed part 5. We were in 1983, and you had met this wonderful woman named Lori, and she was working at Petrified Forest, and you were working at Grand Canyon, and a long-distance relationship was going on there. And
yep.
What was your... You'd gotten an advance of some sort at Grand Canyon working in interpretation?
Actually, it was, I had gotten a bump at Petrified Forest,
okay.
But I think I went to, Grand Canyon on a lateral.
Okay.
Just to get into a different park and into a different position. So, and I had gone up to Grand Canyon. I was working in interpretation at the Yavapai Geology Museum. And in those days, the museum was different than what it is today. And
how so?
It was the geology museum, but it was very, very basic. It was that old, you know, aiming for the fourth graders or whatever. So you walk in the observation deck, the front room with the big picture windows.
Right.
It was laid out so that in front of the windows there were these murals of just the panorama that was laid out, you know, in the canyon before you there, and then the names of the different geographic features were identified, but none of the geologic features.
Okay.
Then the center of the room was open, and between the two log pillars on either side of the room was a television set in a case that continually showed a little video of the dimensions of the canyon, pretty much. You know, so many Eiffel Towers deep, so many Golden Bridges, Gate Bridges across, and that kind of stuff.
With
little flying squirrels.
Okay.
One was an Abert squirrel and one was a Kaibab squirrel, although most people didn't notice that. Then in the back of the room, the big entryway into the exhibit room actually had a partition in it. So there was a doorway on either side of that big arched that big square entryway that's there today. It was a doorway on either side, and then a partition with a closet inside, and on the observation deck side of it, there were a couple of racks of GCNHA publications, and then storage space inside, and then on the back side of it, that was one of the exhibits in the exhibit room, and the exhibit room, as you walked in, on the south, the south wall was this giant display. We called it the time clock, and most of the wall was covered with black plexiglass, and then in the center was a big circular clock face, and it would tick once a second, and these three little LEDs would light up and gradually move around and fill up a circle that went from floor to ceiling. And as the tick marks went around, to the right of the clock, there was a rock column of individual individual specimens of different rocks from the Grand Canyon. And at the supposedly appropriate time, the name of the rock would light up underneath the specimen. So gradually the rock column from bottom to top would fill in with the names of the major rock units.
Okay.
On the left-hand side of it, there were drawings of different types of prehistoric life. And during the appropriate times, whether it was dinosaurs or trilobites or whatever, during the appropriate times that they were around in geologic history, a light would come on behind those drawings so that you could actually see them through that black plexiglass.
Okay.
And so this thing was back there ticking away all the time.
Do you know who came up with that idea? Do you know who made it?
I believe it was Harper's Ferry, the NPS Design Center at Harper's Ferry. And I don't know, maybe the best thing to do is just talk a little bit about the time clock and then on to the other exhibits, which won't take very long. So initially the time clock was all done with fiber optics. And in the back storeroom of the building, there were these huge plexiglass wheels with spotlights, floodlights, shining on them. And then the wheels would slowly rotate, and they had aluminum foil masks over them. And so as the wheels rotated, these floodlights would light up fiber optic cables that would lead to different parts of the exhibit.
Hmm.
And for the little tick marks that went around the clock, that was just the end of the fiber optic cable coming out. And then for the panels that lit up, the fiber optic light would trigger a photocell that would turn on the light behind the label for the rock name or the prehistoric life. And then also tied to that was a ticker. So it would make a clock ticking noise.
Hmm.
And so this whole thing, it was massive. It was, you know, went all the way almost to the ceiling. So it was probably about 7 feet tall. And, of course, the wheels were just as wide as they were tall because they were circular. But then you added on the light boxes for the two side displays of the rocks and the life. And so the whole thing was probably about 10 or 12 feet long.
Wow.
So it took up most of the room. And that back room was also our break room.
Okay.
And so we had that ticker back there. And there was no speaker in the museum part of the room. They just had the volume on the ticker loud enough that in the museum you could hear the ticker through the wall from the back room.
Huh.
So needless to say, it was really loud back in the back room. And it broke. Shortly after I started working there, we'd all talked about how annoying it was and how fragile it appeared to be. And it just quit working, and we had no idea how to plug it back in again.
Is that right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
See.
So the biggest problem, well, there were a couple of problems with the exhibit. I think the concept was actually a good one.
Hmm.
But nobody really understood it. It wasn't something that you could just kind of like intuitively grasp.
Ah.
And so we had to kind of explain it to people. But on top of that, it was supposed to represent all of Earth history, but the artistic folks decided that there was too much stuff lumped up at the end, so they spread the events out so that even though it was supposed to represent geologic time, nothing was actually happening on the clock in the correct proportion to when it happened in geologic time. It was just completely wrong.
So all the billions of years where there was no life was kind of dull and boring, and then when life showed up in the last, I don't know, 500 million, something like that, then things kind of were happening, but so they kind of skewed that timeline, is that?
Right, yeah, and instead of, you know, if you assume that, if you assume that the clock was the full 4.5 billion years of the Earth's history,
okay,
the Grand Canyon story shouldn't have started until, oh, say around 7 o'clock.
Right.
On the clock.
On a 12-hour clock. Yeah.
Yeah, on the 12-hour clock. So instead, it started about 3 o'clock.
Hmm.
And other things were just, you know, likewise skewed, but not by the same amount.
Okay.
And so as a result, we had the major exhibit in the back room was really hard to understand. And once you did understand it, it gave you totally wrong information.
Yeah. Interesting.
So as a result, but besides complaining about it, we pretty much ignored it. You know, we didn't really use it for interpretive programs or anything like that. It just sat there, fortunately, silently, eventually, clicking away. And if people asked about it, why, we'd explain how it was supposed to work and that the events really weren't shown in their right time frame, although the order of the rocks as they lit up was correct.
Right, right.
So that was the main exhibit in the back room.
So it seemed like it could have worked, sort of, if you'd simply disconnected the speakers to the clock.
Well, what they did while I was there, they changed the system from the big plexiglass wheels and the fiber optics. They changed the whole thing so that it was all solid state.
Okay.
So instead of massive structure, it was all being run out of a box that was literally a little black box that was about 8 inches by 2 inches by maybe 6 inches deep or something like that, with a bunch of wires coming out of the back of it.
Yep.
And when that happened, we tried to get them to redo it so that it would be, you know, the timing would be correct. But they wouldn't hear of it.
Okay. This is Harper's Ferry that wouldn't entertain it. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But it must have been irritating to the superintendent to have this thing there, but it doesn't work, or at least to Jack Davis, I would think.
It was, it was certainly irritating to those of us who knew, but apparently not irritating enough to get it changed.
Okay.
So.
I mean, it must have cost a lot to build a thing, get it in there,
and maybe that's why it didn't get changed.
Yeah. Yeah, huh. You know, it's funny because when I think of that building now, I don't recognize any of the things you've talked about. It's all retail space for sales.
Yeah, it was today. I'm trying to think. Yeah, the way it's set up today. The observation deck is still the observation deck, although it's, you know, it's different, but the room is the same. And then the exhibit room is pretty much the same, but as you're in the sales area, there's a little passageway to a back door.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all completely walled off, and that back door was the only entrance into the back room where the mechanism for the time clock was, and where we took our breaks and, and stored books and that sort of thing. So to get from the back room into the exhibit area, you had to go outside and around to one of the front doors, you know, the side doors of the museum to get in.
What else was in the exhibit room?
Well, on the west wall, there was a big satellite photograph of the Grand Canyon, the eastern part of it, basically from Marble Canyon, the north rim, north to about Nankoweap and south past the South Rim a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And west over to, I can't remember if Havasu was on it or not, but somewhere over in the Havasu area.
Was as far as it went.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And it was one of those Landsat images. So it was, you know, that was the technology of the time.
Mm-hmm. That would have been.
It wasn't, you know, a great photograph. It was all lined like the old Landsat images were, but it was still kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then on either side of it, it had two theories. Each was illustrated with three wood block relief maps. One of them showed, and the theories were the origin of the river. And the one on the left was Powell's idea of the river being here and the land just gradually rising up
mm-hmm.
on either side as the river cut down. And then the one on the right was McKee's stream piracy theory of how the canyon formed. And again, by that time, neither one of them was considered correct, although we didn't, kind of like today, we still didn't have a good idea of how it actually formed, but we knew that although both of those ideas played a role, neither one of them was the answer to the question that was implied by the exhibit. So that was on the west wall. And then on the east wall was just a collection of photographs of the Grand Canyon. They may have all been inner canyon pictures. I can't remember for sure. But each one, if you can imagine a box with the photograph on the top of the box, but then the box placed sideways and against the wall. So it was these different boxes with photographs looking out into the room, and each box protruded out a different distance. So it was a pretty exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't do it, but I know some of my coworkers, when we were giving indoor programs, like in the winter or bad weather or something like that, their program was just to talk about some of those pictures. They wouldn't talk about all of them, but they'd develop a program around some of them and then use the pictures kind of as their props.
Okay.
And then on the north wall of the back room, in other words, on the back side of that partition that
right.
divided into the big entryway, was a collection of fossils that had been found in the canyon. A couple of them were under plexiglass domes because they were type fossils. In other words, they defined a species and probably technically shouldn't have even been on display.
Mm.
And then a little label as to what the fossils were. And so it was a good prop for, you know, giving a paleontology talk. The fossils were just kind of randomly arranged, though, so there was no, you know, oldest to youngest or plants and animals or anything like that. There was
wow.
no arrangement to them. They were just kind of scattered on the wall.
Okay.
So that was the back room.
And then what was on the floor? What was it just big and open with nothing there?
For the most part, in the front room there was the two TV pedestals, and then the Natural History Association bookshelves, and then a sales shelf over by or a sales counter over by the west side doorway.
Okay.
And then in the back room, again, the floor was pretty much open. There was a bench in front of the fossil exhibit with a big trackway, big slab of sandstone with reptile tracks in front of the other fossils. So that was about it. There was nothing that I can remember. Yeah, I don't remember anything in the entryway on the east side of the building. You just walked in and there were the big windows, but
okay.
but nothing there. And then at that time, the floor was carpeted. and we had that was it was carpeted, but maintenance didn't clean the museum. I really don't know why, but our shift, our early shift started an hour before the museum opened, so that we could come in and vacuum the floor and wash the windows and dust off everything and all that sort of thing. So we were the maintenance crew.
And did you guys clean the outside of the canyon side windows?
Some of us did.
Okay.
I would do it. At that time, we did. Gosh, I'm trying to remember if we had any. We didn't have a official harness, but we did. If I recall, we did have some kind of a harness, because there is a guy wire up above the windows, and
that you could kind of clip onto.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Yeah, you could clip a carabiner over that. And so basically, in the wintertime, the windows just got dirtier and dirtier. But when the weather was nice enough, there were a couple of us that would go out, and I was one of them, that would go out and wash the windows out there.
Okay.
I had one time when I was washing the windows, and there was a raven that thought it would be fun to play with me. So he started dive bombing me, which I really didn't appreciate. And so finally, on about the third or fourth time, when I realized, okay, he's just doing this for fun, he dive bombed me and got a face full of glass cleaner. And that discouraged him from continuing.
Right. I bet. Huh.
So,
and that's kind of an impressive drop there, isn't there?
Yeah, it is. It's pretty much straight down to the Hermit from there. So it's a good over 1,000 feet, almost sheer drop.
Yeah, and you're on this little ledge.
Yep, the little catwalk out there.
Yep, with no railing behind you.
Nope.
A little harness and a little carabiner up overhead, and ravens kind of exploring your limits of tolerance.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, it was it would not be OSHA approved. So we had under the building in the Kaibab limestone there. There was what we called the cave. It was a little tunnel that was pretty much dead center under the front of the north side of the building. And when I first started working there, it was full of junk. Prior to the remodeling, they used to do lectures at Yavapai. And I remember going to an evening program up there when I was in college in the 70s, just on vacation to the canyon. And they would take all these folding chairs, and they were all clamped to these long 2x4s. And so they could fold up the chairs and then take a whole row by the 2x4 and stack them away someplace. And then when it was time, they could just, you know, bring out a string of chairs, plop them down on the floor, and then go through and unfold the chairs, and they'd all be lined up. And so the lumber and the folding chairs not attached to each other, and some other miscellaneous lumber from some old exhibits, I think, were just kind of tossed into the cave.
Huh.
And one of our projects was to clean out the cave. And I actually used to, when the weather was good enough and it wasn't icy and snowy down there, I'd actually go down to the cave to have my lunch, just to
get away,
get out of the way, and not have to just sit in the back room of the museum.
Mm-hmm.
Go down there and there were a few folding chairs left down there, and I just set up one and enjoyed the view of the canyon while I had my lunch.
So was it big enough to stand up in?
Yeah, it was about, it was probably about 7 feet tall and, maybe 5 or 6 feet wide, and went back maybe 20 feet.
Okay.
Just as a tunnel today. It's all full of microwave equipment for the inner canyon telephone system.
Oh, interesting.
But back after we cleaned it out, it was essentially empty when I was working up there.
Okay.
And then so we would work up there, and we had a number of programs through the course of the day. And as long as the weather was at least halfway decent, we would try and do the programs outside. Either there was not the little amphitheater to the east of the Yavapai Point overlook like there is today. There's a metal railing with some logs and rock benches today, maybe 50 yards, 75 yards east of the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't there at that time.
Okay.
So we had some benches at the just along the paved walkway there. And we would give short talks out there, and then we would do an hour-long geology walk out to along the Rim Trail to Grandeur Point.
Okay.
And then the short talks we gave, we do a 15-minute canyon talk, which could be on any subject, and a 20-minute geology talk, which would be on geology. And then in the summertime, we did an afternoon hike to Cedar Ridge at 4 o'clock. And then in the wintertime, we would get evening programs.
So you'd walk all the way from Yavapai to the Kaibab Trailhead and back?
No. We would drive out.
Okay.
And, we didn't have a government car. It was all personal vehicles.
Huh.
The Kaibab Trailhead was open. The shuttles weren't.
Okay.
Weren't running out there at that time.
Right.
So, we would just drive our own car out there and meet the folks at the trailhead.
Okay.
And head down. And then the other thing that we would do periodically, let's see, I'm trying to think, yeah, those were the programs that we gave. And then periodically we would rove over to Mather Point. And at that time, the pavement ended right at the overlook that goes down the steps to Yavapai, the actual Yavapai Point, the railed overlook there.
Okay.
And so then from there over to Mather Point was just social trails through the woods. And we would rove over to Yavapai, partly to talk to visitors, although there wasn't a developed trail, so there weren't a lot of visitors. But the big reason we went over was to scare off the bead sellers. Because at that time we had a lot of Navajo ladies from the Cameron area who would come into the park and sell jewelry at different overlooks, which wasn't allowed. And so when the rangers would show up, they would gather up their stuff and run off into the woods.
Hmm.
And so we would rove over to Yavapai and see all these Navajo ladies running off into the woods. And that was kind of a mission accomplished. And then we rove back to Yavapai again.
And they'd all come back out of the woods and set up shop again.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Pretty much. Yeah. It was definitely a whole cat and mouse game. The law enforcement patrols would go out and arrest them periodically, but but a lot of times it was just scaring folks off. And at one point, my folks came up to visit me, and they had a light green van, and they pulled into Mather Point, and they told me later, "Yeah, we pulled into Mather Point, and all these people ran off into the woods."
Huh.
Because their van was light green, they thought it might be a Park Service one, and they weren't taking any chances.
Huh. So. Yeah, which is a fascinating. I mean, did anybody think about the fact that the First Nations peoples were on the landscape before the Park Service showed up, and that, you know, they were still living in the area, and were trying to make a living, selling arts and crafts?
As far as I knew, anyway, that wasn't part of the discussion.
Okay.
And in fact, even on the res, they hadn't set up the permit system like they have today for the little stands or booths or that you see along the Little Colorado River Gorge coming up from Cameron to the park.
Right.
The tribe didn't want those out there either, and I don't know what the politics of that really was. But so that was one of the reasons why they would come into the park, was because they would get chased off the pullouts on the reservation as well.
Wow.
Huh. So things have definitely improved since those days.
Right. Right. And now, of course, the First Nations are doing the arts and crafts right there in the watchtower.
Yeah.
And at Desert View. So that's, you know, a huge step in a real different direction. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, yeah. So that was pretty much my job. I would periodically, we would shovel snow in the wintertime, do first aid, had a lady slip on the ice and break her leg one day, and we would, and we'd have people collapse usually from the elevation.
Right.
So we would first thing we'd do is call dispatch and then tend to them until the EMTs showed up.
Did you guys have radios, or would you use a phone there to call dispatch?
We would. Pretty sure we used radios.
Okay.
Don't recall if we had a phone up there at all. I think it was all by radio. We had, there was no, well, there, and then there was no plumbing. Well, there was water in, but no sewage out of the building, which I think is still the way it is today.
Okay.
So we had a sink in the back room, but then there was a drain under the bucket bucket under the drain that we would periodically have to take down to the restrooms and empty into one of the toilets.
Okay.
And if people forgot, then it would overflow.
Right.
And flood the back room. Let's see, what else did we have? That was really about it. And when I first started working up there, I was working for Dale Schmidt. And
so Dale was in interpretation working under Jack?
Right. Yeah, at that time we had a visitor center supervisor who was Larry Fredericks. And then Dale Schmidt was the Yavapai supervisor. Susan Lamb was the supervisor out at Desert View and Toussaint. And then Stu Fritz was over on the North Rim. And then he would come back over to the South Rim and do administrative type stuff in the wintertime and then be on the North Rim in the summer. And then we'd have a seasonal supervisor for the West Rim Drive, the Hermit Road. And that was, there was a information booth right at the West Rim Interchange, because it was, by that time, Hermit Road was closed to private vehicles like it is today, although not as much of the year as it is today. But there was an information booth right at the interchange, and then rangers roving at different points and programs given at some of the different overlooks out there.
Okay.
So that whole operation, including the supervisor, were seasonal.
What do you remember about Dale? And his last name is spelled S-C-H-M-I-D-T.
Right. Yeah. Dale was, he was a real sweet guy, but he was a real odd guy as well. He was very much interested in interpretation. You know, that's really where his heart was. He had some, at that time it was not just Dale. It was just the way the operation worked, where we would work 40 hours a week, pretty much entirely in public contact. We very seldom had anything like project time or program preparation time or anything like that.
Hmm.
We would get get a little bit of time to pull our slides for our evening program and that sort of thing. But for the most part, you know, we were just out on the front line, which really got to be onerous. Yeah, but he was pretty insistent about it. But he was also kind of a make do sort of guy. When we were all kind of frustrated with the quality of the exhibits in the quote unquote geology museum, and so we had put together, I think he actually built it, a tray that kind of hugged one of the TV monitors that had rock samples in it, some good sized rocks, maybe 10 inches on the side of different rock layers, so that people could actually see some of the rocks from the Grand Canyon. Huh. Periodically, the Vishnu Schist would get stolen, but the other ones all lasted the whole time I was there. We came up with back in the old days, probably a couple of Yavapai Museum redecorations earlier, there used to be two big relief maps in the observation deck of the museum. One of them dated from probably the 1920s. It was made by the USGS. I think it was plaster. And it was of the entire southern Colorado plateau.
Wow.
And it wasn't great. It had the major cliffs on it, the Echo Cliffs, the Grand Canyon, Zion, Bice, and that sort of thing. But there wasn't really very much detail. And the last time I saw that one, it was hanging in USGS offices down in Flagstaff.
Oh, my. Okay.
And then there was another one that was, and that map was, as I recall, maybe 4 by 5 feet, maybe 3 by 4, somewhere in there. And then there was another map that was much more accurate. It was of the old Bright Angel Quadrangle. So it covered all of Bright Angel Canyon. It extended essentially from the village over to the head of Bright Angel Canyon.
Okay.
And it was probably about 3 by 4 feet. And initially it was painted in somewhat realistic colors, but also somewhat geological, you know, delineating layers.
Okay.
It was kind of a hybrid. The rim country was all green because there were forests growing on it and that kind of stuff. And that one was made out of these big, probably was about 6 pot metal, just chunks of pot metal. Really, really heavy.
Ah.
And somewhere along the line, we found one of those, and it was kind of beat up. The metal was fine, but the paint was just a disaster. Mm. And so one winter, I painted it to match the geologic map of the Grand Canyon.
Ah.
And I just kind of set up shop there on the counter next to the NHA Clark. And it was a great conversation starter. You know, people would come over and they'd ask what we were doing and all this kind of stuff.
Where did you find it? Where was it? Where was it hanging out?
I don't remember. I do remember that we had one of the original painted ones. When all was said and done, we had one of the original painted pieces on one of the TV monitor cabinets, and then we had the geologic one that I painted on the other TV cabinet. But I don't remember where they appeared from.
Huh.
So you know, Dale was good with that kind of stuff, but he was also very insistent that, you know, we were there to talk to the public, and one of the things that he was real big on was that we weren't supposed to sit on the ledge there by the window. We were supposed to be out there mingling with people. And so when he was around, that's what we did. actually had better luck if we had our hat on so people could recognize us.
Mm-hmm.
We had better luck sitting on the ledge, and then people could gather around us and talk to us. So, and later on, I will probably get to it, but I did some river trips at the GTS, and he wanted me, he would resist freeing me up to go on those trips and wanted me back in the museum the afternoon of the day we took out.
Wow.
So it was, you know, he was pretty persnickety about that. So, and I guess that would be kind of a segue. Well, other things that I did do every now and then, I would get pulled to do like VIP tours because I was permanent, I guess. I outranked people, and I did a good job at it. So, like, I walked from Hermit's Rest into the village one morning with the president of West Germany. I had the director of the National Park System in the Republic of China, Taiwan, and things like that.
Nice.
And so we would do periodically, you know, special programs like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably what I should do is segue into, well, no, before I do that, I'll finish up some of the other stuff. Dale was subject to furlough. And so during Dale's furlough, I would supervise the museum and handle any personnel issues that came up, which were pretty minor.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'd be stuck with processing people's pay and this, that, and the other, and just be the contact person for the museum, and do evaluations of people's programs and that sort of thing.
Okay.
We would, in the wintertime, we would cover breaks for the NHA staff. In the wintertime, there was just one NHA person and one ranger.
Okay.
Who would work the museum. And so we'd cover each other's breaks and that sort of thing.
All right. What do you remember of Stu and Donna Fritz? And that's F-R-I-T-Z.
From that time, pretty much nothing. Okay. I met Stu, and but he and I just really didn't interact that much with that job. I did get to know him a little bit better later on, but never real well, because by the time when I came back in my resource management positions, I wasn't working in the same division.
Okay.
But we'd talk every now and then because I'd see him down the street or whatever.
And I do
remember how much he loved Zion.
Mm-hmm.
that was actually kind of a bone of contention between Stu and Jack O'Brien, was that Stu would, when he was on the North Rim, on the weekends he would always take off and go up to Zion or use his annual leave and go up to Zion, and Jack wanted him to stay there.
I wonder why he didn't get a job over at Zion.
I really don't know, but it was kind of fun, and it was also kind of, what do I want to say, a sign of the times, you know, that we had to put all of our programs together on our own time. Stu was supposed to stay on the North Rim on his days off. You know, it was just kind of still in the days where the Park Service attitude was you're just lucky to have a job with us and you'll do what we say.
Right. Which didn't make a lot of sense on the North Rim, because you need to go to Kanab or Page for groceries.
Yeah.
You know, your days off, you've got to leave.
Yep.
So, interesting. And I wonder, of course, his wife Donna, I think, was working trails at the time. So he would
be. I don't know when the little bit of contact that I had with Donna was after she was working for the Forest Service down in Tucson.
Okay, yeah, because apparently she was on the first ever all female trail crew.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
And yeah, didn't So Stu wouldn't have necessarily wanted to uproot to go to Zion if Donna had a job working trails, and you know, that's part of the mm-hmm. couple's dual career dilemmas of how do you work out two jobs in the agency that can be limiting yeah. limiting where you go. You mentioned Larry Fredericks.
Mm-hmm.
Fredericks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what do you remember of Larry?
Short fuse.
Okay.
He was he was the visitor center supervisor, and he would you know, the operation down there worked just fine and all that kind of stuff, but every now and then he would just blow his top, and it was, and he did it me one time. He didn't like the way I talked on the radio, and I don't remember what it was. And it's kind of, you know, I was at Petrified Forest. I was a dispatcher.
Okay,
I knew how to talk on the radio, but he didn't like something I said, that I should have used 10 code or whatever, and so pulled me aside one time when I'd gone down to headquarters, pulled me aside in the hallway, and started yelling at me.
Wow, right there in the hallway. I mean, that's not a private space.
No, it's not, and he wasn't my supervisor, and I thought the whole thing was stupid, so I just laughed, which made him madder and madder.
Oh.
But that aside, I got along okay with Larry.
Okay.
I, you know, it was kind of like one of those, I didn't care for his management style, but that was, it really wasn't my concern.
Mm.
So.
Because you weren't working for him,
yeah.
under him.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. You were working
yeah.
under Dale.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I really didn't want to work for him.
Uh-huh.
Kind of like, okay, I can take Larry, except when he's yelling at me in the hallway. I can take Larry
mm-hmm.
In small doses, but I was glad I didn't have to deal with him.
Yeah. And then Susan Lamb, LAMB.
Right. She was out at 2CM, and I really didn't know her out there. But then at some point, then I don't remember what caused the whole reshuffling, but Dale wound up going to the North Rim, and Susan wound up coming over and supervising Yavapai for my last, like, 8 months there. And she was much more amenable to collateral duties and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And both she and I were getting tired of interpretation by that time. And sort of fed off of each other, and both of us wound up, you know, leaving interpretation one way or the other. Susan went on to become a writer, and married Tom Bean, and make a wonderful pair.
Mm-hmm.
And I left Grand Canyon for a resource management job.
Right. Yeah, she left the park. She left the Park Service.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Which. At the end of the job, I was ready to do as well. I kind of set up a timetable where if I don't get something better, I'm going to resign and go back to college.
Oh, wow. So let's talk about interp burnout. The people change, but the canyon doesn't, and the geology doesn't, and the flora and the fauna don't. So you've got a fixed thing you can talk about. The people are the only thing in front of you that's changed, and I would imagine that could get fairly boring pretty soon.
It did, and it was on the one hand, I could give my programs pretty much on autopilot,
right?
And get up in front, and I'd be standing there talking, but I'd be thinking about, okay, where do I want to go this weekend, and that kind of stuff, while my mouth just ran on. And it got really frustrating. You know, it was kind of like, okay, I've been here for 3 years, and still nobody knows where the restrooms are.
Right.
And
because they don't. They're all new. They don't know. They don't know the geology. They don't know the flora and the fauna. They don't know the restrooms and where the food is, where to park and where to camp. And
well, and that was one of my big frustrations was that we were stuck answering the same questions over and over and over again.
Right.
And as far as I was concerned, the what we call the non-personal interpretation, the signs, the brochures, and that kind of stuff, were falling down on their job because they weren't directing people to the things that they wanted to know. And there was a bit of realism when I was working the visitor center on my seasonal job. The visitor center desk there in the headquarters building, right immediately on the left of it was the little hallway to the restrooms. And there was a sign over that doorway that covered almost the entire top of the doorway in 3 or 4 inch letters that said restrooms. Hmm. And people would walk up and ask us where the restrooms were.
Right.
So I knew that, you know, signage wasn't the only answer. But at the same time, at Yavapai, the restrooms are in a separate building down by the parking lot. People would come all the way up to the museum to ask us where the restrooms were, and we'd send them back down to the parking lot. And
right.
Why isn't there a big sign down at the parking lot telling them where the restrooms are? And so that was part of the frustration, and part of the frustration was, no, we know all these different things, but we are set up with information desks and all that sort of thing. We're set up to spoon feed people information that they could find out for themselves. You know, if they look in the park brochure or the newspaper or whatever, a lot of that logistical kind of stuff, they've already been provided that information. We should be doing something different so that we're subject matter experts rather than talking newspapers.
Right, and that makes sense because they've already got the data in the guide mm-hmm. that they were given when they drove in the park.
Right.
So you would have the ability to talk about something else.
And it was you know, one example of that was the Geological Society of America had their Rocky Mountain section meeting, which is Utah, Colorado, Northern Arizona, Wyoming, you know, basically the Rocky Mountains. But they had their annual section meeting in Flagstaff one year.
Okay.
And the weekend before the GSA meeting in Flagstaff, a lot of them came up to the Grand Canyon. And I was getting questions that were just delightful. They weren't the same questions that I was
nice.
Asking. They were about the Grand Canyon and that kind of stuff. And so for a couple of days there, I was just, you know, having a wonderful time because it was a different group of people that were there to learn about the canyon rather than to tick an American icon off their list.
Right. You know, I would think that the issue you're talking about here, which is boredom in interpretation, it still could be an issue today. I just kind of thought, gee, you know, would it be interesting if, you know, you had some sort of rotating schedule where you were 2 months at Grand Canyon, and then you had to interp 2 months at Bryce, and then you had to interp 2 months at Zion, and interp 2 months at Glen Canyon, to at least keep you on your toes and familiar with a broader geographical area and different geology and different, you know, different parks and their resources.
And that's one of the advantages of a seasonal position.
Ah.
Yeah, I was talking a little bit earlier about, you know, no matter what happened, you knew that, you know, in no more than 180 days, you'd be out. And
right.
And that was one of the advantages there, was that there would be a variety of things to talk about. And spending just a few months over 3 years at Yavapai, I was completely burned out.
Right, but permanent employees, that's different. You don't have the option to look at, hey, I've only got 30 more days of this, and I can put up with that, and then I'm going to head out to someplace else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and I did, you know, I did do some other stuff. Sometimes it was minor. I did a lot of graphics work, making maps. The South Rim supervisor, who's Ernie Escalante, she found out that I could do calligraphy.
Ah.
And so from that day on, every certificate that she had to hand out, I did the calligraphy on, rather than just, you know, use the primary ball on the IBM Selectric and type it out that way.
Uh-huh. Well, you got to keep your skills going, your skills sharp in calligraphy, so that's nice.
Yeah, I did some of that, and I did escape on a few wildland fires.
Okay.
It was kind of tricky because, of course, Dale didn't want me to be gone, and and so I had to make sure that I had covered my position for the duration. I remember it was just for a few days. One time they told us one of the things about wildland fire is that they're always real closed mouthed about what you're going to do and where you're going to be going.
Mm.
And so they called me out on a fire one time and didn't tell us that we were going to some big fires that were burning up at the time in Idaho.
Ooh.
But very strongly suggested that we'd be going to Idaho. So, you know, I'm throwing all this warm stuff into my fire pack in the 2 hours that I've got to get ready to go.
Hmm.
They sent us down to a fire in the Catalina Mountains outside of Tucson.
Ooh.
So we were only down there for, I think, 3 days or something like that. But we were just roasting.
Wow.
The whole time. None of us had any really lightweight stuff. So
dragging all your heavy gear with you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Boy.
Yeah, walking around in our underwear when we're not on the line, because that's the only thing we have.
Yeah.
Lightweight.
Huh.
So, then another time I spent actually 2 weeks up in northeast Oregon and Idaho, the Hell's Canyon area. And we did in that 2 weeks, it was super dry. They had fires starting all the time. They sent us out. We were what's called a pickup crew. We weren't a regular fire crew, like a hotshot crew or a tanker crew or something like that. We were a pickup crew, a bunch of people that they picked up and thrown together to make a crew. And so usually the pickup crews are the ones that aren't on the initial attack. They're the ones that are coming in to mop up or clean up or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did spend a day fighting a fire in Hell's Canyon. We were out in the woods one night to clean up a fire line, and it was a dark, moonless night, and the wind came up, and we started hearing all these trees falling around us.
Oh, gee.
Because we've been weakened by the fire, and it's kind of like, this isn't safe. And so we're stumbling around in the dark to where we could find a clearing so that we wouldn't get hit by any falling trees, and then we just sat in this clearing and told stories to each other until it got light enough in the morning to see, and then went out and got back to work again.
Hmm.
So I was out on fire a little bit, but most of the time we were just hanging around fire camp waiting for an assignment. And, you know, one of the things about going on a fire is, you know, coming back with fun stories to tell, but a big part of it is the pay, you know, the hazard pay and the overtime and all that. Well, when we're hanging around fire camp, we're just pulling straight eights. You just get, if you're not out on a fire, you get paid $8 a day of your regular pay, and that's it.
Right.
And so I think we saw every video in the little Joseph Oregon video collection. Had a TV set up.
Hmm.
Fire camp was in the rodeo grounds, and we were there every day watching. I was gone for 2 weeks. I think I spent 3 days on a fire, and the folks I'd left back at Grand Canyon made more money than I did because they'd had to put in all this overtime to cover for me.
Right. And meanwhile, your boss is grumbling because he's got to work out schedules and give people overtime, and that's costly. And
yeah, and and I'm just sitting in the rodeo grounds watching
videos. Dear.
So that, that particular one didn't work out all that well. So let's see, also, you know, at the same time that I was doing that job, I had a kind of a night job where in 84, so like 6 months after I got there, Yavapai College in those days was running the community colleges for Coconino County as well, because Coconino County hadn't set up their community college yet. And so Yavapai College in the spring of 84 was offering a Grand Canyon geology class. And I thought, oh, this is great. You know, I'll sign up for this class. It was in the evenings. Sign up for this class and learn some stuff and kind of pick up my game, because I definitely, my programs just by default were almost all about geology. I had some programs about Native peoples and, you know, flora and fauna and all that sort of thing when I needed them. But generally my programs were on geology because I figured, no, that's our main resource.
And was this class held in Flagstaff? So you'd have to drive into Flagstaff, or was it actually held?
No, it was actually held at Grand Canyon.
Really? Okay.
Held in my high school. So I was going to sign up for this class, and 2 weeks before the semester started, I got this phone call, and it was Yavapai College, and they said, yeah, we were talking to the park, and your boss says that you do a lot of geology programs, so we were wondering if you'd like to teach our Geology of the Grand Canyon class, because we don't have an instructor for that.
Wow.
And so like a fool, I said yes, and I said, so what do I need to do? And they said, well, you need to do the one thing you have to do is a field trip to Phantom Ranch. But beyond that, you know, it's kind of up to you. And it's a 3-semester-hour class. And so I spent that whole spring 2 weeks ahead of the class doing research.
Wow.
For the weekly lectures on Grand Canyon. And we did 3 field trips. One of them was just a short one, a couple hours long. We went to Mather Point for just kind of a general overview of the canyon early on in the semester. And then we did a hike down the Hermit Trail to Red Top to talk about paleontology. And then we did our Phantom Ranch hike. And it was funny. I taught the class for 2 semesters, and every year, the first day of class, I would announce that, yeah, we're going to do a field trip to Phantom Ranch. And everybody, of course, taking class is a local. You know, oh, God, do we have to go to Phantom Ranch? I've been to Phantom Ranch 1,000 times. Yeah. Well, we'd get on the trail with a bunch of locals, and all of us had seen things that others hadn't seen, and I'm talking about all this stuff, and we would get to Phantom like at last light. It would take us all day to get down the South Kaibab Trail.
Nice.
So it turned out to be, you know, it turned out to be fun.
And who were you? But, who were the students? Who were you? Who signed up for the class?
It would be different people from the park, and not just Park Service. I had a couple of tour bus drivers. I had a pilot, a helicopter pilot. One of the best was one semester I had a mule wrangler,
okay.
Mary Lois Shriver, who eventually was Mary Lois Brown. But she was a wrangler for Fred Harvey. Did the mule trips, and then also ran the beauty salon there in the Bright Angel Lodge.
How do you spell her last name?
Shriver, I think it's S-H. It might be S-C-H, but I think it's S-H-R-I-V-E-R. And since she was a wrangler, The first semester, she got us a deal where, like, for $5 a piece, we got to stay in one of the cabins down at Phantom.
Oh, wow.
And so it was a you know, generally speaking, it was a fun group of folks.
Fun.
That we did the class with. I did the class, and at the time, I was trying to make it an introductory geology class.
Okay.
And I think it could have been a lot more fun. Kind of a case of I saw it as an introductory geology class in the community college system, and looking back, you know, from with perfect 2020 hindsight. You know, nobody was taking that class as their introduction to geology to go on to pursue a degree. They were taking it because it was Grand Canyon.
Right.
And so I could have skipped a lot of the technical stuff and probably made the class more fun. But anyway, that's how it goes.
Yeah.
And like I say, the whole first semester, I was like 2 weeks ahead of the class doing research. And so I was checking out pretty much every geology book in the research library.
Wow.
And they were all piled up all over my living room. And Louise Hinchcliffe was the librarian at the time. And I don't know, have you interviewed her?
No, I have not.
Okay, yeah.
And I think she passed away, didn't she, recently?
Yeah, she did. Yeah, a few years ago.
And so I want to know what you remember about her.
No, she was great, because she liked me. She was, you know, she had been around forever. I don't know. She may have been cook on the Powell expedition. No,
right.
No, but yeah, you look at the old photographs, and there she is. And she was the librarian at the time, and at that time she was pretty much the classic librarian. Of course, by that time she had to be in her 60s,
right?
And you know, just the sharp face and hair drawn back in a tight bun. She knew every book in the library, where it was, and all that kind of stuff, and. And she could have a sharp tongue if she needed it. And there was one point I found out later from Kim, but Kim Crumbo came into the library looking for a geology book. And he said, and it wasn't on the shelves, and it just wasn't, you know, wasn't showing back up again. So I asked Louise about it, and she says, Carl Bowman has that book, and he needs it more than you do. When he brings it back, then you can check it out. So she was covering for me while I was monopolizing the entire library.
Right. Oh my gosh.
And one of the things I noticed was that I could tell when the park had a geologist on staff, because the library holdings were pretty complete. But then, along about the early 60s or so, there was nothing past that, and so they got a whole list of. Books that I'd gotten from NAU that the park should have copies of.
Hmm.
They thought the park should have copies of. And a lot of them were, you know, different master's theses and
right.
all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So the park did go ahead and get copies of those. So I was teaching this class, and that kind of made me the geology expert for the park. I became kind of the de facto park geologist. And it's kind of amusing because I'd only had like two classes in geology.
Mm.
But the resource management division would have me review geologic research proposals. I started doing geology training for seasonals in interpretation, backcountry. Crumbo got me on the early GTS trips back when the Park Service was still running them.
Yep.
I went on a couple of those as a geologist. It kind of not only did I learn way more geology than I ever would have if I'd taken the class, but it kind of made me into the park geologist.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
So.
Cool. Maybe this is a good time to wrap up this interview, because I can see that you're going to leave interpretation, and I would like to know about the early GTS river trips. And that's probably going to run us right off the rails for our time frame.
Oh, okay.
Does that sound like a plan?
Yeah, I think, let me take a look here at non-GTS type stuff, blah, 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 VIPs. I could tell you about when we weren't allowed to kill mice that we trapped in the museum, so we'd throw them off the rim after the visitors were all gone and watch them fly down.
And the ravens wouldn't catch them on their way.
No, and a mouse's terminal velocity is not lethal.
Oh.
So we'd pitch them off the rim and they'd fall 3,000 feet and start climbing back up the cliff to come back into the museum.
Got it.
Yeah, squirrels are actually right at the borderline. Any animal smaller than a squirrel can pretty much survive a fall from any height.
Hmm.
And squirrels sometimes can and sometimes can't. But
you didn't drop squirrels off the edge, not the ones that were begging for food.
No. This was just the mice. We'd set up a trap with a trash can. You'd take a trash can, you'd make a ramp up to the lip of the trash can, and then you would suspend a chunk of peanut butter in the middle. So they'd run up the ramp, jump to get the peanut butter, fall into the trash can, and then in the morning or in the evening, we'd take the ramp and the peanut butter off, take the trash can outside, and pitch the mice off the rim.
They'd become astronauts.
Yep, they'd spread out their little legs and tail and just kind of fly on down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
my, oh my.
but yeah, I think aside from that, and commuting back and forth to Petrified Forest all the time.
Right. Okay. All right.
That pretty much covered it.
It sounds like a good place to wrap this part 6 interview up then, with Carl Bowman. Today is Tuesday, November 17th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Carl, thank you so very much.
Well, thank you.